Well, welcome to the Collector's Show for another week of All Things Collectible. I'm Harold Nickel here on Web Talk Radio. A very interesting and different kind of program coming up for you this week. In the interview segment, we're going to be learning about how to not just recognize an unusual collectible item of furniture, but where you might have something like this repaired, because it isn't obvious what you're looking at a lot of times, and with the right kind of repair and refurbishment, you can have something that isn't just valuable, but comfortable and fun to have around. And I'll have more to say about that at the end of the segment. And then in our talk with Larry Zale, we'll be discussing sports collectibles, which I think is very relevant due to the fact that the whole business about Little Cooperstown and the autographed baseball exhibit came up last week. And if you haven't seen that story, you can read it on the Collector's Show website. And that site is just one word, collectorsshow.net, and there's two S's. And I post all of the news from the show, and I post different other kinds of information during the week that collectible folks like yourself will enjoy. So be sure to visit collectorsshow.net. But Larry will be talking about sports collectibles, and this is going to be the first of a two-part series. So, as promised, here's a little bit of news from the world of collecting. This has gotten my attention more as a marketer than a collector, but you'll remember a couple of weeks ago we did a show on LEGO collectible minifigures. Well, they've done an absolutely brilliant, they being the people at LEGO, brilliant advertisement for Christmas this year, and I've posted a link to it on collectorsshow.net. You'll want to go there and see it because it reinforces some of the things we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that LEGO has really, not just as a toy, but as an industry, helped to redefine the tangible plaything and married it in different types of media, not the least of which is multimedia video games and movies, because along those same lines with this new commercial that they've got out, there is going to be a LEGO movie. And the LEGO company has introduced 16 minifigures for collectors, all of which are going to appear in what is supposed to be a LEGO movie. And I'll have a picture of this on the collectorsshow.net. And I found this kind of in an email from the LEGO company last week. They had a picture of the Series 12 collectible minifigures, and these will be out in January of 2014. And according to LEGO, the collectible series of never-before-seen LEGO minifigures gets its first Hollywood treatment with an all-star lineup of 16 characters appearing in the LEGO movie. I'm not sold on the idea of an animated movie or a movie of any kind on LEGO, but if you had asked me about their tie-ins with Star Wars, I'd have said the same thing and been absolutely, positively wrong. Now, this is another piece of news for people who are more the hobbyist in terms of collecting, and I have collected Coca-Cola items over the years, but when I collect things, I never expect to make any money at them. Well, there was a show in Tennessee, and it featured collectors of Coca-Cola memorabilia, and it described the fact that although this particular individual, a woman whose name is Linda Prabish, who owns over 1,000 Coca-Cola items, that just because something says Coca-Cola doesn't mean it's worth anything. And one of the things we'll be talking about next week is the difference between, is it old and collectible and worth something, or is it just old? And there is a difference. So just hanging on to things for years and years doesn't automatically qualify them as useful or valuable. And that includes popular things like Coca-Cola memorabilia. I'll post this on the collectorsshow.net as well. But Linda has her entire kitchen decorated in Coca-Cola. She has about 1,000 different pieces. It's taken over a good bit of her house. And what she says that got me interested was that people want to know what their items are worth. And she says that they'll find some nice pieces of Coca-Cola memorabilia that she buys, but that more often than not, people are disappointed to learn that what they have is interesting but not valuable. She also has as her most prized possession a 1970 Coke vending machine, and I don't mind saying that I have also a Coca-Cola vending machine, but mine's from about 1960. It's one of the ones that you had to open up the door and pull the bottle out. So, if you want to read those items and more from the world of collecting, I invite you to the collectorsshow.net, and it's just collectorsshow.net, and you can read all about it there. Now, coming up in the interview segment, it's an interesting combination of people who were looking for vocations for their disabled adult children, interesting antique furniture, popular during the turn of the century, and a place in Houston, Texas, where you might not believe that collections as famous as the Manil Collection have turned to have their antique furniture redone. And that's coming up next on The Collector Show here on Web Talk Radio. I'm Harold Nickel. Well, salvation comes to people, animals, plants, and as it turns out, furniture, under circumstances that can't always be predicted or even imagined. And that is the topic for us this week on The Collector Show. I was looking for something for us to discuss on the show that dealt with antique furniture, as that's a very popular collectible, and we hadn't done anything with it before. So, like a good collector, I decided I needed to narrow the focus to something more specific. Since we've recently moved back to the Houston area, my wife and I, where it's always hot and humid, I thought architecture and furniture from the time before air conditioning seemed promising. And I didn't have to dig very hard or very long to discover caned furniture. Caned furniture uses mats. Mats of weaved or woven wicker on the seat backs and on the seat bottoms. It was popular in the late 1800s and the early 1900s in climates like this one, because these woven mats facilitated airflow where upholstery or fabric never would. I can remember when I was a kid literally sticking to my grandmother's upholstered sofa, and she had air conditioning, and I can imagine what a sweaty mess it was for people on that kind of furniture in the days before air conditioning. But that was why people used caned furniture. Well, lots of people have old chairs, and a lot of those chairs end up damaged because they just wore out, or a dog chewed it up, and sometimes the mats for the seats or the backs are completely missing. Well, what do you do with these types of chairs when you find them at estate sales or in your attic and you have no idea what to do with them or how to repair them? Well, I found the place for caned furniture collectors or enthusiasts to take their furniture for repair, but there was so much more to the story than antique repair or cane chair collecting, and I wanted to share it with all of you. So for the interview segment this week, we're going to meet Lonnie Holly, who for 25 years has led the caning operation at the Center in Houston, Texas. Now, the Center is a place in Houston for people with intellectual and development disabilities. The people who are doing the work on these caned chairs are known as the Cullen Caners, and they restore cane rush and wicker furniture. They work for antique dealers, museums, decorators, businesses, and individuals. This is a group of very skilled craftspeople who can repair just about any of the most complex patterns in furniture. Their skills are unique all by themselves. There aren't very many people who can do this kind of repair work. That individuals who are at the center do this kind of highly skilled work, I think, is a very special and unique story, nothing like what we've ever talked about on The Collector Show before. So, with that, please meet Lonnie Holly, the Center in Houston, and the Cullen Caners. Tell me a little bit about the Center and the background of the Center and how you all came to be involved with caning.
In 1979, we had one of the mothers of a client which wanted to have a creative craft going for the clients, sponsored by the volunteers. So the mother did get a book and taught the volunteers what she could about caning, and then in turn, they taught the clients.
So this was an effort by someone who had a relative
yes.
who came here. What was the original objective of caning, and how does that continue today?
Oh, it's a creative craft. You know, like I said, the volunteers, at that time it was a volunteer program only. So they learned to do from the book what they could and then taught the clients how to do this. And in turn, here we are today. They do an excellent job, wonderful. So, and so proud of them.
Let's talk about caning and the kinds of furniture, antique furniture, that have to be worked on. Tell me about the process and where we can find these types of items.
We work on, naturally, the chair bottoms. We do backs. We've done tables. We've done baby carriages. Anything with this material on it, we can replace it.
Do you often find that it has to be completely replaced or just repaired?
No, most of it has to be completely replaced. I can repair a small hole, but it has to be small so I can splice onto the canes. So you can't tell it's repaired.
Now let's talk about the vocational training part of caning. How successful have you been here at the center with this as part of your vocational efforts?
Very well. All of our caners in the vocational have a sense of significance. They're able to say, I have a job, and to feel worthwhile to others, and a skill like no one else does. Very few people can do what our caners do.
And I'm glad you said that, because I want to talk about the rarity or how hard it is to find somebody to cane older furniture. I mean, it's not something that you see every day, is it?
No, it's not. And like I say, the caners I have are experienced. It takes the hands working with the mind in order to create this intricate pattern on whether the chair or the back, whatever it might be. So the caners, they replace the seat, and this is bringing the past into the present. When they create the seat and make it new again, the chair goes back into being useful, and the caners have been successful in doing this, and they're always so happy and so pleased with it.
It sounds like it's a way to bring objects and tangible items that people have loved in the past and make them relevant again. Is
yes.
that a fair statement?
That is a very fair statement. And in the past, we have had customers that have thrown things away because they could not find anyone to replace their pieces until they found us. And we can replace a seat or back or whatever they might have. The caners with myself, together, we can make it happen.
How long does it typically take to recane a chair? And I recognize that they're all different,
yes.
but give me an average.
The average is probably, depends on how many holes are in the chair. Some of our caners might take a week. I think the most would be 2 weeks. I think we can get something completed in 2 weeks with all caners.
How big is your staff here? Can you take on a lot of projects at once, or are you somewhat limited?
No, we can take on a lot of projects. Naturally, we have to have them, you know, done in a timely manner, and we understand this, but we're prepared to do that.
Let's talk about how the service here compares with that of traditional furniture repair in terms of cost to the person who needs their furniture repaired. Is it more expensive, less expensive, comparable?
No, I think this is a good question, because probably every 6 months ago, I check with the places that do the hand caning and find out how they charge, and we do slightly under that. So it's really good.
So you're very competitive.
Very, very competitive, yes. And besides, we're the best in the city or anywhere else as for our caners and caning. That you will see. It's my caner's job to do the do the caning on the seat or back, whatever it might be, but it's my job to see that this is as good as it can get.
Now, when we talked before, and you mentioned in the city, we're in the city of Houston.
Yes.
You had mentioned that there are times when you redo other groups' repair work. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, we do. We have had our customers bring into pieces into us that another caner has done from the garage or from wherever he might be caning, and we've had to redo these things many, many times.
How satisfying is it to your workers that they know better than somebody else in the outside world?
Oh, they are thrilled to death. The twinkle in their eyes when they've completed this and knowing that someone outside did this, but we're going to do it better and a better job. So they're so, so pleased. And they should be because they do a terrific job.
That brings me to something else. You know, we talked about the price a minute ago, but there's more value to this than just price or cost. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yes, there is more to it than the price or cost. When our customers come in, naturally we give them a price. And when they come back, I usually, most of the time, take them in the back where our caners are working so they can see them at work and know what a wonderful job they're doing. So, and this is very pleasing to our customers too, and also to the caners, because they love to show what they have done. They're really pleased with it.
So we could call that a non-monetary value?
Yes, that's non-monetary, but it's very, very important.
One of the things about furniture collecting and museums is that each piece from a collection has a unique story, and that, to me, is what makes antique furniture really interesting. And we had talked before about the fact that a lot of these pieces also had stories behind them. Can you share one of those with us?
Yes, I will. We've had a family that lives here in River Oaks that go to Paris every year for vacation. While they're gone, I suppose their dog gets really upset because they miss them. So the dog chews the chairs up. Susie has chewed 3 chairs up while they were gone, 3 years in a row. So they decided in order to fix it, they would have to take Susie with them. So Susie is now going to Paris with family, and we haven't done the chair in about 2 years.
That's a good one. The dog would chew up the caning of the chair.
Uh-huh. Because it missed the family, probably.
Yeah, it probably, at the end of the day, is less trouble to just take the dog.
Just take the dog, yes, and I'm sure the dog was very happy. But that story alone, that just the group in there, the caners, laugh about that many, many times because of the dog going to Paris.
Lonnie, is there anything this afternoon we haven't talked about that you think is important to mention?
I think you have covered about everything. The group that I have here, like I have said, they're the best in the city or anywhere else. With them and myself and Alder working together, there's nothing that we can't accomplish. And again, when they have a problem, I don't run over and fix their problem. I have them look at it, evaluate it, and try and find out where they've made the mistake and fix it themselves, and then they're really happy because they have done something without my help. But naturally, I'm always there to help.
Sure. Thank you, Lonnie, so much.
Thank you, Harold, very much. I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
So, it's that time on the Collector's Show, once again, where we talk with our friend Lawrence C. Zale, who is the president of Lawrence C. Zale Associates Incorporated. He is a very accomplished visual arts advisor and nice enough to let us call him Larry. And Larry, welcome to the Collector Show.
Harold, thanks so much for having me.
So this week, you're going to take us into the world of sports collectibles. It's something that certainly speaks to me as a lifelong sports fan, and likely to a lot of our listeners as well. Where in this big world of collectibles are you going to take us?
Well, I'm going to first take us down the path of differentiating between memorabilia and collectibles. The idea of taking photos, cards, jerseys, and all sorts of related sports equipment, and calling it memorabilia really requires a signature which can be authenticated by a qualified dealer.
Okay.
Many of us are tempted to look at and purchase sports memorabilia with the expectation that it can be authenticated, but unless that it can, it then falls into the category of being a collectible.
Okay. That's a good distinction.
At the same time, we're going to be confused by both words being conveniently interchanged when really there should be a difference between the two.
So words matter in this space like they do in so many others.
Yeah. So if you have a jersey that is signed by Mickey Mantle, unless it can be authenticated, then I think it's safe to say it would qualify not as memorabilia, but as a collectible.
Okay.
And I should add that even though it is a collectible and its value will no doubt be less than it would have been if it were memorabilia, it still has intrinsic value.
So help us understand what that is, what that value is for collectors.
You collect objects, in this case sports memorabilia, essentially for two reasons. It appeals to you privately, and we've discussed this phenomenon of passion coming into play, where in the case of sports memorabilia, it harkens back perhaps to days of your life or that of your father or grandfather or other family members.
Mm-hmm.
And that has an intrinsic value that may not necessarily be high in financial value.
Right, okay.
So that doesn't take away from its importance. The only difference will be the value.
Okay, so it's meaningful but not necessarily something you could monetize or make money at.
Right, so it's symbolic, but it isn't necessarily one that also has high financial value.
Okay.
But as listeners will recall, if you want to become a more sophisticated collector, bordering on a connoisseur, you're going to want to insist as a prerequisite the works be authenticated before you purchase them, and then you must make sure that you keep those letters and other materials which serve to authenticate the object.
I know that in instances where I've owned things that were certified, there literally was a certificate of authentication that came with the object. So collectors should expect something similar with things, whether it's baseballs or cards or autographs, things like that. Is that right?
Absolutely. But when it is authenticated, it's important that they make sure that the authentication is what it says and it is not a fake. So you can not only fake signatures, but you can also fake letters or postings of authentication. So it's important to get that qualified. And the way that you do it is research the body that is authenticating the object to make sure that they are qualified.
Ah, so, and there was an item in the news lately about a very large collection of autographed baseballs where some of the signatures are thought not to be authentic. And what that collector should have done is ask more questions about the body that was certifying those as actual or not fakes or counterfeits, right?
Mm-hmm.
How?
So there's two levels. There is to first get it authenticated and see that documentation, and then to make sure that the documentation itself is authentic.
Yeah, it's like who guards the guards? Are there signs or tip-offs that people can recognize things that are not authentic that you may have experienced in your work?
Well, for example, in the signature, there are standards that people use when signing their name. An expert will be able to look at it and say, well, wait a minute, there's not a necessary loop over this particular letter, whereas here there is. Sometimes the signature looks too good to be true, and I don't want to sound predictable by saying that it probably isn't, but you need to be careful about making sure that you can get the signature authenticated from a qualified source.
Okay, and it's okay to be predictable because, as we all know, if things seem too good to be true, they like they are.
Right.
And we were none of us born cynical. We all had to learn that from being burned over the years and things that were quote-unquote authentic but turned out not to be. In the case of sports collectibles, are there organizations that you could recommend?
Well, I think collectors should first visit sports memorabilia shows.
Mm-hmm.
There they'll find an encyclopedic variety of dealers, institutions, and others who are promoting various sports that can be collected. I would also recommend that collectors follow the sports memorabilia sales. They can do so by going to various websites.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Heritage Auctions has a section on sports memorabilia. There are others as well, where they can log in and follow various sales as they occur or after they've been auctioned to see the results and use those results as a basis for their own acquisition of memorabilia.
That's a good word. That's a good word. And a big outfit like Heritage or other similar organizations is certainly a great place to start.
Another way that they can gain knowledge is to talk with other collectors. It's been my experience, collectors, no matter what they collect, tend to be pretty open about their area of collecting. They may not talk specifically about their particular objects, but they tend to be somewhat open about the area that they have decided to collect. And they can be great sources of information.
Mm-hmm.
Without necessarily being biased, as you would get from a dealer or from a company that's looking to sell a particular product.
And as many collector and collectible clubs and organizations as there are hours in a day, or probably more, particularly when it comes to a field of collecting that's as popular as sports memorabilia and one that is potentially lucrative or expensive depending on which end of the transaction you happen to be on.
Right. And the last area where they can become very knowledgeable is to view public collections and speak with the curators if they're available or their assistants. If you send them an email or leave a message with a particular question and it's based on sound research, they will typically get back to you with a response.
Sure.
And if they can answer you, often they will recommend someone who can.
So information is, again, our friend, and getting better acquainted with people of similar interests is not only best practice, but a way to get in touch with people of similar interests. So that's very helpful, as always. Larry, thanks for sharing with us. Now, typically, this is the part of the show where I tease what's going to be on next week, and I ask you if you've ever heard of a certain thing.
Right.
Okay, I have no idea what's on next week. So people will just have to come back and find out for themselves what we're going to talk about on the Collector's Show next week. Several things that could happen, but I don't want to say anything that could be potentially misleading. Just come back and find out like the rest of us.
I like the mystery.
Yeah, it's it gives a little intrigue to the show that could probably be attributed to just poor organization, but we'll say it's intrigue and that we did it on purpose. But hey, thanks as always for being on with us.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
And for the rest of you, please come back to the Collector Show next week and find out what's going to be on here on Web Talk Radio. For Larry Zale, I'm Harold Nichols. Thanks for listening.